Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Donald Trump and Republican leaders will reportedly now turn their attention to tax reform after pulling the Republican bill to repeal and replace Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act for lack of Republican votes. But even Democrats say while the suggested Republican changes were draconian in their minds, Obamacare does need repair. A handful of states only have one insurer on the exchange, and in pockets, people are seeing big premium increases. Bill Clinton, during the 2016 presidential campaign, infamously called Obamacare the craziest thing in the world. So what truly needs fixing, and can that happen politically? President Trump has said he'll just let it explode. Julie Rovner is a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. And Julie, could you start with expanding on what are the critical problems?
Well, as you just mentioned, you know, in some parts of the country, there are very few insurers. It's possible that next year there will be no insurers in some parts of the country. And premiums have gone up dramatically in a few states. It all depends, you know, where premiums began. In states like Arizona, where you saw 100% increases, it's because they basically underpriced for the first couple of years. But indeed, people are concerned about rising premiums. They're particularly concerned about rising out-of-pocket costs, these very high deductibles and co-insurance and co-payments. And people say, you know, we're required to get insurance and we want to be insured, but then we can't afford to use our insurance. So there are some serious problems that I think everyone agrees needs to be addressed.
Well, a couple of things. Some of the architects of Obamacare are saying if those states, if many states had just expanded their Medicaid, as we'd asked, that would have taken care of some of these problems. But where do you see places where Republicans and Democrats can work together to spackle it? What could be the fixes for some of those rising premiums or no insurers?
Well, one of the important things, well, there's a couple of things. One of them is that the Republicans actually worked to kind of undermine the law by taking away some of the backstops for the insurance companies that were losing business. And in fact, in the Republican bill, they were going to put those back. And that's something that I think Republicans and Democrats could agree on, that if you, lower the risk for the insurance companies, they'll be more willing to get into the market. Mm-hmm. The other thing that needs to happen is that the individual market, people who buy their own insurance, they need more younger, healthier people in that market. One of the things that some people have been talking about recently is that maybe it wasn't such a great idea to let kids up to age 26 stay on their parents' health plans. Maybe they should be in the individual market since they're the young, healthy ones and don't cost that much. And that would help spread the risk more broadly among people who are in that market.
Boy, that's a popular aspect of the
it is.
But we're talking about compromise. And Democrats may have to give that up to get some of the things they want.
Republicans want that, too.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Is there a chance? And people, Americans may have to give it up to keep their health care. Is there a chance for compromise, though? The Trump administration needed some of the cuts to Obamacare to pay for the planned tax cuts the president wants. Maybe Democrats can get some fixes to health care and in return go along with the tax cuts. I mean, where do you see compromise?
Well, you can see places where there could be a compromise. You could certainly see a compromise between the moderate Republicans and the Democrats, or at least most of the Democrats, if President Trump wanted to play it that way. I don't know whether he wants to really cut out the conservative Republicans. I could see the Republicans getting together on a plan to just turn more of it back to the states rather than restructure it from Washington, let the states go out and experiment. That could conceivably pass with just Republican votes. So there are a lot of different ways this could play out. But, you know, waiting for it to implode, it's not entirely clear that it will implode. On the other hand, the Trump administration could facilitate that implosion.
Well,
there's some steps they could take that would make it collapse a little sooner.
Just briefly, what about the concerns that Republicans could exacerbate the problem and make it implode?
Well, one quick thing that they could do is drop this lawsuit that a federal judge last year found that the cost-sharing subsidies for people with low incomes to help them pay those deductibles and out-of-pocket costs are illegal. And if the Trump administration dropped the appeal of the lawsuit, that decision would stand. Those subsidies would go away. That would have a huge impact on the entire individual market and would speed up the problems.
What is your sense, Julie, of Congress coming back to health care? They say they're moving on. The Republicans say they're moving on.
Well, they will have to, you know, it depends how many insurers decide that they're going to offer coverage, and we'll know that later in the spring and in the early summer. And if it's really bad, then I think Republicans might have to come back to the table, and they might have to go to the Democrats. But, you know, it's all sort of and very fluid right now. Obviously, the committees in charge of this have other things that they have to do, including some health-related things. So you could see it, you know, involved in some other bill.
Yeah. Julie Rovner, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. A new day dawns after the Republican plan was pulled on Friday, and we'll see what happens going forward. Julie, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Authorities in Hong Kong are cracking down on pro-democracy activists there after the election of a new pro-Beijing leader of Hong Kong. The activists say they have been told they will be charged in connection with protests that happened almost 3 years ago. Hong Kong enjoys a special status under China's One Country, Two Systems policy, which guarantees that Hong Kong's political systems will not be changed for 50 years following the British handover in 1997. So while citizens in mainland China do not have freedom of speech, citizens in Hong Kong are supposed to. Joining us from Shanghai is NPR's Rob Schmitz. And Rob, what are you hearing about this new crackdown? What's going to happen to these pro-democracy activists?
Well, today, Hong Kong police called at least 9 organizers of the large-scale protests that happened 2.5 years ago, and they told them that they would be charged with creating a public nuisance in a public place and that they should turn themselves in. So these 9 protest organizers have just turned themselves into police, and they face maximum sentences of a few months in prison each.
And is it just a coincidence that this happened just after the news that there's been a new leader, a new pro-Beijing leader of Hong Kong elected?
Well, the leader herself is saying that she had nothing to do with this. But I think that a lot of the organizers of these original protests and people who are known as localists, people who are fighting for more rights in Hong Kong, are definitely thinking that this is not a coincidence, that this is exactly the kind of thing that they were fearing before this most recent election that ushered her into power.
Well, and tell us more about her. Her name is Carrie Lam.
Right. So Carrie Lam is a lifetime civil servant in Hong Kong. She was most recently the city's chief secretary, which is the city's second in command. She made a name for herself by helping Beijing try to change the city's election laws so that the election system that Beijing would be happier with would be implemented in Hong Kong. But that entire process spurred massive protests that shut down the city's financial sector for more than 2 months. And during those protests, she represented the city government in negotiating with student protesters who were fighting for more democracy. In doing so, she gained the favor of the communist leadership in Beijing. And so she was elected as chief executive by what's called an election committee. And this is a group of mostly pro-business and pro-Beijing electors, 1,200 in all, who voted for her on Sunday after China made it clear that it wanted Lam in that position. Despite trailing in all the public opinion polls to an opposing candidate, she won the election with 777 votes.
And what does that say about Hong Kong's status? We mentioned the one country, two systems policy, but are people worried that that policy is just a policy in name only?
That is precisely what they're worried about. You know, Hong Kong is what is known as a special administrative region of China. And for 150 years, it was ruled by Great Britain. And then it was handed over to China in 1997. You know, at that time, the British and Chinese negotiated how the new territory would be governed. And it was decided that Hong Kong would have a high degree of autonomy from mainland China and would be allowed to govern itself. In fact, the Chinese promised that Hong Kong could work towards universal suffrage, in other words, letting all of its citizens vote for the city's chief executive, something that the British never allowed. So this agreement is what is known as one country, two systems. But the problem with that is that in recent years, China's government has increasingly interfered with Hong Kong's affairs. It has refused to implement an election system that gives everyone the right to vote, and it has imprisoned and kidnapped people who speak out against Beijing. So many of these actions violate the promises that Beijing made when it took control of Hong Kong. And the umbrella movement was spurred by Beijing's refusal to give Hong Kong residents the right to vote for their leader.
So has this new leader, Carrie Lam, said anything about trying to reach out to the pro-democracy movement?
Yeah, in fact, this was one of her big promises after she was declared chief executive on Sunday. She said she would work to heal the divide in the city. But these arrests today are making people wonder if she's going to make good on that promise.
Rob, I want to ask you about one more thing while we have you. You've been in contact with a professor from Australia who has also been detained in China. What's the story there?
His name is Feng Chongyi, and Professor Feng is an Australian permanent resident. He is a citizen of China, and he was doing work here in China interviewing human rights lawyers. Now, this group of people, human rights lawyers, have been targeted by the central government in the past 2 years, and many of them have been arrested, imprisoned, and tortured. And so he was doing that type of field work, and pretty soon, as during his field research, he started being followed by state security agents who followed him across the country to the city of Guangzhou in southern China. And that's where he tried to leave. He tried to leave twice. He tried to fly out, but he was on a no-fly list thanks to these agents. And these agents detained him. They questioned him. And right now, he's still in Guangzhou. I've been in contact with him today. He seems to have a fair degree of freedom in the sense that he can email, but he's definitely under surveillance, and he's not sure when he's going to be allowed to leave.
Hmm. That's NPR's Rob Schmitz joining us from Shanghai. Rob, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
This past weekend, we attended the Boston University Conference on Narrative Writing. Journalists and historians, including presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, speaking to packed audiences about their craft. Her book on Lincoln, Team of Rivals, became the film by Steven Spielberg. Another on Eleanor and Franklin Delano Roosevelt won the Pulitzer. Her look at Lyndon Johnson had its start when she was Johnson's White House intern. We spoke before our keynote conversation about the fledgling Trump presidency. The Republican health care bill was supposed to be a triumphant victory, but leaders dashed to and fro trying to get votes, and it was ultimately pulled for lack of them.
Well, I think there's no question that it is it's a huge problem that's been created for this young presidency of President Trump. The whole idea when a person becomes president is, what are your priorities? And I remember Tip O'Neill said something, you got to dance with the person who you brought to the dance.
It's the Speaker of the House.
Yes, the Speaker of the House. And what I would have assumed would have been the first priority of business would have been infrastructure and possibly tax cut. The infrastructure could have gotten the Democrats aboard. Tax cut might have been a bargaining thing, which is what the Republicans really wanted. But by going for this crazy, difficult, complicated problem first without knowing you had your own party behind you, I think it's just going to cast a shadow on everything else.
Can you think of another time in history where there was this type of event?
Not really, because I think we've never had in history before a president who had absolutely no political experience or military experience. So that it worked during the campaign because he ran a brilliant campaign in some ways, reaching out to people who felt left behind by the Democratic Party. But then the difference between campaigning and governing is so huge. And the fact that President Trump didn't stop doing his tweets, which allowed him during the campaign to get a lot of coverage, and he loved them. But then the negative tweets, I think, just took and sucked up the news. Even in these last weeks, we were talking much more about wiretapping in Russia than that very health care bill that should have been the priority of all the messaging for the last few weeks.
What about what's happening within the Republican Party? The fact that what happened, even though the president blamed it on Democrats not coming aboard, the fact that you have one arm of the party that's fiscally conservative, doesn't want to spend anymore, you have the moderates in the party who are afraid of cutting out health care, and a president who thought he could arm twist both. Is there any example in history?
Well, when you think about even during President Obama's presidency, that part of the Republican Party proved impossible for anybody to work with. It's almost as if they're against governing, not just on conservative principles, and would rather lose a fight rather than compromise in any degree to get a possible bill rather than a perfect bill.
Well, of course, they're saying the same thing now about the Democrats.
Well, there's no way they could have imagined that the Democrats were going to vote to repeal Obamacare, the signature achievement of their president and their time in office. When they passed that bill, they really felt they had done something, rightly or wrongly, with some of the provisions of the bill that their children would be talking about, or their grandchildren years to come, like Medicare or like Social Security. I'm sure that there have been times in history that have been worse than this. In fact, I was on a plane the other day and I was telling a woman that who was so concerned about the whole anxiety and fear today. And I said, oh, look, it was much worse in the 1850s. I mean, the obstructionism of the people in the South versus what was going on in the North. And they brought guns into the Senate chamber and the guy from the South hit the Massachusetts senator over the head with a cane. And she said, yeah, but that ended up in a civil war with 600,000 dead. So I said, oh, I better think of a better example.
Well, can't you go forward to the 1890s? 90s. We just read Stephen Kinzer's book, and there was a huge battle over whether or not the U.S. would seize the Philippines or other countries, and there was the same kind of fist fighting in Congress.
Now, I think the 1890s actually are the best parallel for what's happening now, not simply because of imperialism and what was happening abroad, but rather the Industrial Revolution had created much of the same emotional anxieties that technological revolution and globalization have created today. People were moving from farms to cities. There was a lot of inventions going on, the telephone, the telegraph. A lot of people felt life was speeding up in ways they didn't know. There was tons of immigration coming in from abroad. And it was a time of demagoguery and populism. But luckily for the country, much of that energy got channeled through Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, and the progressive movement into moderate, rational reform that took care of some of the problems of the industrial area, factory exploitation, women and children working too many hours, maximum hours, and railroad regulation and food and drug regulation, so that there was a sense that the problems were being addressed, even though a lot of anger was still out there.
Well, you mentioned Teddy Roosevelt. He came off as kind of a almost buffoonish a bit. You know, I want to go kill someone in Cuba. I've never killed anybody, you know, and a warmonger and kind of reckless. And a self-aggrandizing, you know, he was great at having pictures taken of himself marching up hills and such. And yet, as you say, he's the one who channeled some of that populist energy into good causes.
Well, there were two Teddy Roosevelts. There was the one who was in many ways a warmonger, who had this ridiculous concept that the victories of peace were never as good as the victories of war. And yet, on the domestic front, he was very, very savvy, and he understood what needed to be done economically. And most importantly, and unlike President Trump, he had a great relationship with the members of the press. They became his partners. The investigative reporters at that time who unearthed all the problems that we were having in Standard Oil, in the railroad industry, in food and drug, they would write these 10,000-word pieces that people would gobble up, and that would force then the Republicans in the Congress who didn't want to have regulation to have it because the country was mobilized. And Teddy understood that if he was going to have a relationship with the press, he had to be able to have a relationship where they would criticize him. I mean, there's this great story where at one point a great journalist wrote a review of his book about the Spanish-American War, and he said Teddy was so, you know, not buffoonerish, but so much in love with himself that he put himself in every single instance, every battle of the war. And he should have called the book Alone in Cuba. And so what does Teddy do? Everyone around the country is laughing because this guy's a famous journalist. And he writes him back. He says, I regret to tell you that my wife and my best friends absolutely love your review of my book. Now you owe me something. You have to come meet me. I've always wanted to meet you. And they became friends. He continued to criticize him. Teddy would criticize him back. But they had this strong relationship, as he did with most members of the press. That's really different from what we're seeing today.
What about the relationship with Paul Ryan? Paul Ryan went from the Capitol up to the Oval Office to, according to reports, beg the president to pull the bill because he didn't have the votes.
Well, I think on the opposite side, what you're looking for is a president who, with a majority leader and the leader of the Senate, has such a close relationship that they are working together in tandem and not blaming one another when something goes wrong. That's the last thing you can do. I mean, part of that story you're talking about, I understand, is that originally President Trump wanted to have the bill actually put on the floor so that people had to say no, and then revenge could be taken, and that Paul Ryan persuaded him, I'm very glad that he did, not to do that. I mean, that's not going to help anyone to have revenge out there. I mean, that's been part of what's plagued our politics for the last two decades.
Is there another time when it was a plague, revenge, somebody wanting revenge rather than what's best for the country?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it's a natural human reaction, but then the greatest leaders are the ones who, like Lincoln, was able to say, if I let resentments fester, they will poison a part of me. I mean, that's what Lyndon Johnson understood when he became such a great leader of the Congress, that, of course, there were people he was angry with over the years. There were people who weren't going with him on bills even then, and he could do it in private, but he wouldn't do it in public in the same way.
What about the, staying with Lincoln, the team of rivals? Some thought that maybe Trump was putting together a team of rivals in his cabinet, bringing in even former rivals on the campaign trail. You've got Rick Perry from Texas and Ben Carson.
I think the one encouraging thing was that President Trump was willing to surround himself with people in the cabinet who criticized him during the hearings, especially the foreign policy people, Tillerson and Mattis. They didn't agree with him on a lot of things, the nuclear deal with Iran, climate change. And instead of getting angry with them, which he might have if they had criticized him personally, he simply had a blanket tweet. And he said, my guys are doing great up there. I want them to question me and argue with me. So that part has seemed interesting.
Although you have Tillerson traveling without any press and threatening not to go to the NATO meeting. Now he may be going, but yeah, I hear your point.
Well, I have no doubt that unless a better relationship is developed between the press and the president, then we've got a real problem in a democracy. The Fourth Estate is needed. They need him. He needs them. And sure, there have been controversial times between all the presidents when they get mad at the press and they'll close down a particular reporter or they might shut the television down. But in the end, the best presidents have worked out a working relationship where they will criticize the press will criticize them, and they'll go about their business, both of them. They're both professionals.
We're here for this conference, The Power of Narrative, Storytelling. You are a narrative historian. Have you thought about how you'd write the narrative of the Trump presidency? It is so young, but have you been thinking, turning that over in your head?
I think the biggest question still will be, can the man who campaigned, and we must say campaigned effectively, and tweeted in the middle of the night things that somehow didn't turn off his supporters during the day, can that man realize that once in office, words matter? And I keep arguing that just like Lincoln had hot letters that he would write to people when he was angry with them, and then he would put them aside and never send them, hoping he would cool down and never need to show his anger, that President Trump should have a fake Twitter account. When he's happy, he can talk to everybody. When he's mad, it doesn't go anywhere. Because you can't allow those negative emotions, I think, to rule and change the agenda of the day. A president's greatest power, in some ways, is to set the agenda. And too often, these tweets have set the agenda for him. And maybe not even his meaning to, but because he couldn't control back the anger that he felt.
Yeah. Doris Kearns Goodwin, thank you.
You are very welcome.
That's Doris. Before our conversation at Boston University's conference this past weekend, The Power of Narrative, Telling True Stories in Turbulent Times, in our conversation, she talked about how President Obama convened a roundtable of historians to help him make decisions about present-day problems. Well, should that roundtable be renewed? One attendee this weekend suggested that it should be required that presidents meet with historians. Your thoughts, welcome at hereandnow.org.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson. And you know, a lot of people don't know that podcasts exist. They've never listened to one. At Here and Now, we want to change that. So all this month, we're inviting listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. You can do it in real life or on social media, and make sure you let us know what you're recommending. Tell us using the hashtag tripod, that is hashtag TRYPOD. And thanks. About 55 million Americans own guns, and just under 7 million gun owners are women. How to carry those guns safely, but also stylishly, is behind the growing number of concealed carry fashion shows that are popping up across the country. Leah Fleming from Here and Now contributor Georgia Public Broadcasting reports.
On a Tuesday night at Sharpshooters USA in Roswell, Georgia, a group of women in pink T-shirts that say Lady Sharpshooters across the back are lined up in stalls. The smell of perfume mixes with gunpowder.
Oh, that was her with that gun.
Cassie Weiderman is one of the Lady Sharpshooters. Dressed conservatively in form-fitting slacks and a sweater, she came straight from work this evening. She's shooting her Glock 42. She conceals and carries. In other words, she carries a hidden firearm in public.
I carry appendix carry with an inside-the-waistband holster. Usually I can wear it. I've worn it with these pants before and then just like a tunic, a flowy top, or a pattern top.
The way a woman conceals and carries a gun is as varied as her choice of handbags and shoes. Weiderman says she doesn't like to carry in her purse because she doesn't always have one.
All leather, crocodile printed. This has a little magnetic closure here. They all have...
At the front of this gun store just north of Atlanta is a large section of accessories with lots of pink packaging and luxury handbags and wristlets. The bags are the vision of Leslie Dietz, founder and CEO of Concealed Carry. Carry is spelled just like Carrie Bradshaw, a character from the wildly popular HBO television comedy Sex and the City. Dietz says she named her Concealed Carry line after that Carrie, because of her fabulous style.
They have a wristlet if you want to carry it by that, or we also have little crossbody chains you can thread up through the spine. Comes with a little tassel. That's your wristlet. They all have a tassel and a little key fob.
The retail price is just under $300. Dietz says she got her first gun about 18 years ago, At that time, she didn't want to carry the gun with her because there's no place on her that she could carry it comfortably. She's slender, 5'3", and just over 100 pounds. She says in the past, the problem was that the products available to women were coming from male-dominated companies.
So you had a man designing a handbag, which is usually, unless you're maybe Ralph Lauren, not a good idea.
Over the last 3 years, several women-owned companies have cropped up, offering products like bras with holsters, lacy shapewear that allows a woman to conceal a gun without losing her silhouette, and compression underwear. Many of these items are now showcased at annual fashion shows. Candy Sugarman is hosting the Feminine and Fierce Concealed Carry Fashion Show and Expo this April. She's the founder of the women's only shooting group, Gunpowder Gals, in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Sugarman says after putting on her first show 3 years ago, the women in the audience flooded the runway afterwards to talk to the models.
They actually wanted to talk to people who had currently worn it, and they wanted to have it in their hands, and they wanted, you know, to look at it and put it up against their body and look and to see how if it would work with their gun. And that's why the Concealed Carry Fashion Show is so important.
There are also Concealed Carry Fashion Shows coming up in Fort Worth, Texas, and in Columbia County, New York. And organizers say women are not the only ones that want to carry more stylishly. Designers like Men's Wearhouse appeared at a fashion show last year to show more tailored looks for men to conceal carry. For Here and Now, I'm Leah Fleming in Atlanta.
Close your eyes and think of San Francisco. What colors do you see? Maybe the bold red of the Golden Gate Bridge? What about New York? Maybe the gray and brown of pavement and brick with an occasional pop of yellow from the taxis. What color is your city, and how does a city's color palette come to be? And what impact does it have on the people who live there? We're joined by Lori Pressman, Vice President of the Pantone Color Institute. And Lori, do you think that different cities have different color palettes?
I do think different cities have different color palettes. A lot of what we see that dictates some of these color choices, it could be the climate, the geographical location, maybe the exterior materials for the house. You know, we could be looking at stucco versus clapboard and what makes sense. And even more importantly is the personality of the city itself.
So give me some examples. I mean, I'm thinking of places like Washington, D.C., where it seems like a lot of the brownstone houses aren't brown, but they're colors. They're yellow, they're blue, they're pink even. Whereas, you know, at a place like Boston, it is much more brick. It's a more kind of red brick kind of a city. And then you go to some place like Miami Beach and it's white and light and, you know, matches perfectly with the beach.
Well, you've definitely brought up a great cross-section there, and you're almost crossing not just three different climates, but three different cultures. So when you think about Miami Beach and you think about, especially over the last 20 years, first of all, you're looking at a very warm climate.
Right.
So, of course, white makes perfect sense for something like that. But over the last, and it's probably more than 20 years at this point, I would say 50 years, the influx of the Hispanic community. So whether you're looking at people coming in from Puerto Rico or you're looking at people coming in from Cuba, if you're looking at South America. So I think with a whole different culture coming in, you're also looking at a changing color palette. I think of Washington, D.C. as a really interesting dichotomy. It's a city that bridges, you have this whole conservative thing because of the political culture, but you also have a city that straddles the North and straddles the South. And when I think of the brighter colors there, I think of some of that Southern personality coming through a little bit more, that warmer climate. And then you look at New England and you think of New England as almost, you know, one of the original areas of this great country. And the brick and the Federalist look, it makes perfect sense.
What are some other examples that you can think of in this country of cities that have their own color palettes?
Well, I think one of the most interesting cities to me when I think about this country is San Francisco. And I think about that because when you think of San Francisco, right, we associate that city with being very culturally progressive. So you expect that freedom of expression, and you also look at a climate that is, you know, kind of warm. It's not L.A. for sure,
right,
but it's definitely warmer than some of the Northeast cities. But what strikes me there is the painted ladies, because you think of those old Victorian houses that were built so many different years ago, and you think of how, you know, I guess in the late 70s, they got this name. People were using color as a way to accentuate the individual architectural details on the house. Because if you look at these houses, they all look the same. And yet here now, if you go down to that row and take a look at those houses, it's such a beautiful expression, not just of color, but really of what that city is all about. So that's always the first thing that comes to mind when I think of color in a particular city.
Does it matter for our mood? Does it matter what the color is of a given city in terms of how we feel in that city?
Oh, totally. You know, and one of the things I wonder about, because it becomes a chicken and egg situation, did the color come first or did the personality of the city come first? You know, was there an urban planner all these years back and said, we're going to make the city this color? And some of that we may not know, you know, it could have been one of those things that this came about and you can't always come up with the exact reason. People make up reasons. But I definitely think it influences how you feel. There's no question.
So given that, is there a color that is the best color to make us feel good in a city?
I don't know if there's a color that's going to, you know,
work for
everyone.
This is
the one color that would make you feel good. Yes, I would say, see, here I go back to London for a moment, or even maybe it could work in Seattle. Any place where there's a lot of rain, you might want to see some yellow because yellow warms up any environment. So the minute you see that yellow, you associate it with the sun, and that puts a smile on your face. So I'd have to go with yellow in that sense. And I could also go with a red door because it's also an inviting shade. It draws you in.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to be the brighter colors that are going to be more engaging in that way.
Are you noticing any trends right now? Is there a color that's really hot now?
I go back to the grays because, you know, if you're looking at exterior colors, you have to keep in mind it's not a color that somebody's going to change that often. Typically, what we would advise people is to really stay within the personality of the house. So if you were looking at a craftsman house, for example, you may not want to be thinking about turquoise and white. It just may not work. You might be better off staying with, you know, burnt oranges or a brown-based red or something like that that just fits with the overall feeling of the house. So to us, I would say cohesion is really the big thing. But if I had to look at a color, it's the contrast with white, but it's definitely the grays because that is a color that can go the distance. It's going to look stately. It could look traditional yet chic at the same time, you know. And if you wanted to really change, you know, maybe you add a little bit of a brighter color to the door or to the trim of the home. But once you're looking at exteriors, I think you really need something. I use that phrase again. That's going to go the distance and maintain the integrity of the home.
That's Lori Pressman, who is vice president of the Pantone Color Institute. Lori, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Question. Did United Airlines lose the Twitter war after winning a dress code battle, barring two teens from a flight for wearing leggings as pants? Another traveler, Shannon Watts, witnessed the girls being turned away at the gate in tears. She tweeted, "A United gate agent isn't letting girls in leggings get on flight. What, because spandex is not allowed?" Turns out Shannon Watts has a big Twitter following. Her tweet went viral. United responded with their own tweet. "In our contract of carriage, Rule 21, we do have the right to refuse transport for passengers who are barefoot or not properly clothed." Aye, what they left out from that tweet? That rule only applies to people flying for free, so-called pass travelers like the two teens, employees or their friends and families. They do have a dress code, unlike other passengers. Seth Kaplan is managing partner at Airline Weekly. Seth, this just blew up on social media.
It sure did, Robin. And hey, you know, I'll myself, I mean, when I first heard the news, before I knew the whole story, I said, yeah, that sounds like a little bit much. And I don't know whether United itself knew the whole story when that initial tweet came out, because, look, I mean, reasonable people can disagree about whether the requirements are too strict for pass riders also. But obviously, there's a difference between people who are flying free on somebody's travel benefits, you know, to some degree representing the airline, and the rest of us who are paying. And as long as we're not doing anything terribly offensive, should be able to fly in whatever we're wearing.
Yeah, we may not like what other passengers are wearing, but they have the right to do it unless they're flying for free, which wasn't mentioned until far later on, till after Patricia Arquette, the actress, got in the act. And people took it as a real criticism of young girls who are, of course, wearing yoga pants and leggings as clothing. Here's one of my favorite tweets. Andrew Milspa tweets out, "It's not going to be pretty, but I'm going to wear yoga pants for my next flight." So is this a cautionary tale about public relations and Twitter?
you know, it's just the world in general. I mean, you know, Robin, journalists face this too, the pressure to get something out there before you necessarily have the whole story. And so, I mean, I feel for them. But in this case, it became a much bigger story than it had to become. The fact that they were pass riders is a detail that should have been in the initial communication from the airline.
Right. We have colleagues who have been pass riders in the past because of their family's involvement with the airlines. They say, we had to wear a suit jacket.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I can remember in my post-college years in the late 1990s having friends who worked at airlines, and I would get a buddy pass. And there was one time when I was eligible to be upgraded to first class because there were empty seats, and I didn't have a sport coat, so I couldn't do it. So it's not even just a gender thing. I mean, it's, you know, the whole world has become, of course, less formal since then. And the pass rider requirements have become less formal in tandem, but still more formal than the rest of the traveling public.
Because as United finally said in a tweet, they represent the airline when they fly for free. Seth Kaplan, managing partner at Airline Weekly on Dust Up in the Skies. Seth, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
The battle against ISIS rages in Iraq. There is one waging in Syria as well, both overshadowing news last week from Afghanistan that a completely different group, the Taliban, now controls a key district, Sangin, in southern Helmand province. Sangin was one of the bloodiest battlegrounds for British and U.S. troops during the war in Afghanistan. Its fall is part of the Taliban's push to expand its territory after those U.S. and British troops ended combat operations. Joining us now by Skype from London, the BBC's Dawood Azami, an editor with the BBC's Afghan service. Dawood, what is the further significance of Sangin being back in Taliban hands?
Well, Sangin has become a symbol of battle between the Afghan government and its international partners and the Taliban. Taliban have been trying to capture this district for nearly 2 years. And Sangin is also important because most of the British soldiers who fought in Afghanistan were killed in this one district. Since 2001, when Afghanistan was invaded by the US-led coalition, 456 British soldiers were killed throughout Afghanistan, and more than 100 of them were killed only in this one district. And then in 2010, when American forces took control of security from the British forces, then within 90 days, around 20 U.S. Marines were killed in this one district. And since then, hundreds of Afghan soldiers have been killed by Taliban while defending the district.
Well, so what do you think has happened here? Is the Taliban gaining in strength, or are Afghan forces losing strength?
Well, the Taliban are getting control of more Afghan territory. They control now more territory than any time since 2001. And Sangin is also important because most of the drugs, especially opium, is produced in Helmand province, of which Sangin is a district. So this is also important for them because it brings them more revenues. It's one of the main financial sources of the Taliban. And thirdly, it's symbolically important. It gives them morale, and it weakens the morale of Afghan forces unless it is recaptured soon.
Well, this is the heart of Afghanistan's poppy-growing region, so there's an economic element to this. But you write that the Afghan forces trying to fight back against the Taliban in Sangin weren't getting reinforcements, ammunition, or food. So it sounds like it's stretched pretty thin.
Well, this has been the Taliban strategy, to stretch them thin. And they've been attacking district headquarters in most of Afghanistan's 34 provinces. They are also carrying out attacks in the cities, especially Kabul, the capital. And this has put a lot of pressure on the Afghan security forces. And in some cases, the government is not able to provide ammunition and food and reinforcements to outpost and military bases in all parts of the country.
Well, right now, there are about 10,000 American troops in Afghanistan. They are just said to be in training and advising roles. But I want to talk about Russia, because Senator John McCain and American military officials have said that Russia is assisting the Taliban in Afghanistan. Moscow denies this, but you write that, on the other hand, Russian officials do acknowledge talks with the Taliban. And the title of a recent piece of yours called them Russia's surprising new ally. What's going on?
Well, Russia has been talking to the Taliban for more than a year now, and they have acknowledged themselves that we have contacts with the Taliban. And they have given two reasons for that. One is they want to ensure the security and safety of Russian citizens who are in Afghanistan. And we saw over the past few years that a couple of times, a couple of Russian citizens were kidnapped or they were captured by the Taliban, and then they were safely released. So this is one of the reasons that Russians justify their contacts with the Taliban. The second is the emergence of Islamic State group or ISIS. And Russians think that the main goal of ISIS in the region is to destabilize Central Asia and Russia. So it is kind of joint enemy for both the Afghan Taliban and Russia.
Of course, Western officials say that that's just an excuse, that Russia is using ISIS as an excuse, and that this is all to undermine the U.S. in Afghanistan, which is ironic given that Russia lost its own war in Afghanistan against the Taliban and other warlords, and now might be more bonding with that insurgent group, something to watch.
There has been a conspiracy that Russia might be trying to take revenge. So, I mean, we don't know, I mean, if this is what they want or they are genuinely concerned about the rise of ISIS. We know that they want to put pressure on the U.S. and NATO because Russia has been under sanctions and the war in Ukraine is partly blamed on NATO and U.S. by the Russians. So Russians think that the U.S. and NATO wants to create another battlefield for Russia in Central Asia in the form of ISIS to divert its attention from Ukraine to Central Asia.
The BBC's Dawood Azami in London. Dawood, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.